All right. So, well, let me welcome all again to this webinar, which is a third in a series this week related to data coming from the retrovirus meeting, co-sponsored by AVAC, the HIV Prevention Justice Alliance, and IRMA. The first two calls this week focused on HIV prevention in women on Monday with an update on the FACS microbicide result as well as the Partners Demonstration Project. Yesterday, a call related to financial incentives and cash transfers. Recordings and slides of both of those calls, as recording and slides from this call, will be available, are available already on the website, and the link has been sent around, and you can get it from avac.org. In the meantime, today's call is a very exciting one. As many of you will know, at CROI, some of the biggest news, most exciting news related to data coming from oral PrEP studies, two in particular presenting very exciting data from Europe for the first time in PrEP research. And we are delighted to have both principal investigators from the two studies, Jean-Michel Molina from the ANRS and the IPRGAY study, and Sheena McCormick, if not on, and will soon be on, from the PROUD study in the UK from the Medical Research Council. We're going to have both of them present, similar to what they did at CROI, but with a little more detail, I suspect. And we'll then open it up to questions. If at any point people have questions, please feel free to email avac@avac.org in real time. If you're on the web ReadyTalk function, feel free to put questions into the chat feature. And also, once we're done with both presentations, we will go ahead and plan for people to ask questions live. So we are just about to begin. I believe, Sheena, maybe you are on. Is that correct?
Mitchell, Sheena is just dialing in now. She's having problems getting in to see the slides. So I guess...
Okay. Yeah. I'll tell you what, why don't we do this then? Jean-Michel, if you're all right, I'm going to go ahead and go straight to your slides from the IPRGAY study.
Very good.
That,
let's do that.
Should appear right here. And without further ado, I'm delighted to welcome Jean-Michel Molina from the ANRS based in Paris and who led a team of the IPRGAY trial.
Thank you, Mitchell. So thank you and for being here today, and we'll welcome everyone. So it's a pleasure and a privilege to discuss again the data we presented at CROI this year on the IPRGAY study, this on-demand PrEP regimen that we tested in MSM in France and Canada, since we already mentioned that this is a study done in France, but also in Montreal in Canada. Am I able to move the slide myself? Yes. Okay. My disclosures... And in terms of a little bit of background, you may know that in Europe in general, but in particular in France and Canada, we still have a pretty high number of new HIV infection, and we estimate that we diagnose every year more than 6,000 new infections in France. This is pretty high according to the number of people living with HIV, which is assumed to be in the range of 150,000 people. So the reason why we did the study was because, as you may know, before the data from PROUD and IPRGAY, in MSM and in PrEP trial in general, there have been conflicting results about the real effectiveness of this strategy with oral daily tenofovir FTC, and the main explanation for the differences between trial was the differences in adherence with the daily regimen. So we thought that we might be better off with an on-demand regimen, coitally dependent regimen. And, you know, we based this assumption on the data with the gel, you know, for example, in Caprisa with an on-demand use of gel as compared to voice, where the use of gel was daily, you had a better effectiveness in terms of reducing the risk of HIV acquisition. So we thought that on-demand might mean a more convenient regimen, and that would translate into an improved adherence and improved safety profile, and, of course, that would reduce the cost of the strategy. We have data from animal models, and we used a lot these data to try to design the dosing schedule in Hyper-GA. So these data come from the group at CDC led by Federico Garcia Lerma and Walid Ainini, and they have done a number of studies testing different dosing regimen with TDF and FTC, both oral, subcutaneously, IV, and to test both with a vaginal challenge or a rectal challenge, what would be the best way to use prophylaxis. And this slide is showing actually the best data from their experiment in a macaque model where they used a rectal challenge with a sheaf virus, and they inoculate the sheaf virus every week, so once a week, rectally in these animals. And what you can see in the red dotted line is that untreated control animals became infected very quickly after the first or the second challenge. You see that half of the animals have been infected after two challenges, whereas with the animals, although the number was low, only six, are receiving the double dose of oral TDF-FTC given 2 hours before and 24 hours after the rectal challenge. Almost all animals except one have been protected in these experiments, and these were the best results that they have obtained, and they have tested a number of other design in other experiments in the same paper if you are interested. And actually the only animal who became infected was an animal in which the drug levels in both the plasma and the rectal tissue were actually pretty low, and that there might be a relationship with this lower protection in these animals. So based on these data, we thought we would need to assess an on-demand regimen orally with TDF and FTC in high-risk MSM, and we enroll in the study also based on previous experience with IPREX, and you may remember that in IPREX, the overall reduction in HIV incidence with daily TDF-FTC was 42%. So we thought that we would select a high-risk population of MSM who have had condomless and mild sex with at least two different partners in the last 6 months with a normal renal function. And, of course, all participants will benefit from full prevention services, including counseling, condoms, gel, testing and treatment for STI, even without symptoms, vaccinations against hepatitis B and A, and also for those who didn't know about that, the use of post-exposure prophylaxis. And in one group, the participant would receive TDF and FTC, and in the other group, a placebo. And we would look for reduction. That would be our goal, to show a reduction of HIV incidence by at least 50%. And we wanted to have a power of 80% to be able to show this difference. So we thought initially we would need 64 HIV infections to be able to show a difference with an assumed or expected incidence in the placebo arm of 3 per 100 person years. And so in the study, we followed the participants every month for the first 2 months and then every other month to check safety, tolerability, adherence, and also, of course, whether or not the participants acquired HIV infection. So this slide shows you the way we instructed participants to take their drugs. So for one sexual intercourse, they had to take two tablets 2 to 24 hours before sexual intercourse, and then a third tablet 24 hours after the first intake, and a fourth tablet 48 hours after the first drug intake. So overall, two tablets before, two tablets after, to reproduce in some ways the dosing regimen that was used in the macaque model. And if participants had multiple sexual intercourse on consecutive days, they would take one pill a day until their last sexual intercourse. And in terms of primary endpoint, of course, that was the occurrence of HIV infection. And to diagnose or detect HIV infection, we used a very sensitive fourth-generation assay which allow the detection of both the antibodies and the P24 antigen in serum. We use serum and not whole blood. So we had to do venous punctures in these participants. We also store the blood in order to be able to do an HIV RNA in plasma to be able to really know when participants had been infected. In other words, when we had a positive fourth-generation assay, we tested all the previous blood sample we had to be sure that we these participants did not have primary infection before, at the visit before, and we tested HIV RNA in all previous blood samples available. The secondary endpoint were safety, tolerability, adherence, and we used a different way to measure adherence, the pill count, the plasma drug levels. We used the computer-associated self-interviews on the web. We measure or assess sexual behavior based also on self-report. And we assess the rate of sexually transmitted infection during the study. As you know, following a DSMB meeting late October, and that was following the results and the discontinuation of the deferred arm in the PROG study, we asked DSMB to convene again and look at the data. And when they looked at the data, they recommended the discontinuation of the placebo arm, and they recommended that all participants be offered on-demand PrEP. So this is the study flow chart. So as you can see, we've screened more than 400 participants. 7% were excluded from randomization because of a number of reasons, but of note, 11 were already infected with HIV and they didn't know about that, and I think that's also a clear interest and benefit of a PrEP strategy is to attract high-risk individuals who would like to benefit from PrEP who don't know they might be already infected with HIV. And, you know, being able to detect them with HIV infection, we were able to propose immediate treatment to these people. And I have to say that in all the participants that have been infected in the study, all received immediate treatment. And we explained them, you know, the benefit of early treatment, both for their immune system and also for their partners. And actually, overall in the study, the median time between the diagnosis of HIV infection and the initiation of heart was only 6 days, less than a week. So eventually we randomized 414 participants in the study, same number in the two arms. But again, between randomization and the first visit at which they received their drugs, a couple of people could not really start the study because some of them withdrew consents, were lost to follow up, and also because three of them acquired HIV infection between screening and the day-zero visit. So that tells you, you know, that this was a really high-risk population of people. So eventually, 400 people started treatment without HIV infection at baseline. And overall, until, you know, the study was discontinued, at least the placebo arm, because the study is still ongoing, but open label now, 88% of the participants completed the follow-up. And that was pretty good because in terms of assumption before the study started, we thought that, you know, we would lose 15% of the participants per year, and actually that was actually lower than that in the study. So this was probably due to the care we tried to provide to these people so that they would be happy to remain in the study. And I can say that the participants were happy to be involved in this trial. And actually, they are anxious that this trial might, you know, eventually stop in the future. But that would not happen before some time in 2016. So on the next slide, you could see the baseline characteristics of these participants. So they were pretty young, 35 years of age. Most participants were white. They have completed secondary educations. They were employed. Most of them were single. A third of them had a history of post-exposure prophylaxis use. So that was quite high. Almost half of them have used in the last year before enrollment a drug that we call psychoactive drugs, so including ecstasy, crack, cocaine, crystal, speed, GHB, etc. 20% were circumcised at baseline, but we used very sensitive PCR assays, so these assays could detect, you know, asymptomatic sexually transmitted infection. And actually, at baseline, 20 to 29% of the participants already had an STI, but most of them had an asymptomatic STI. In terms of sexual activity in the prior 4 weeks before enrollment, the number of sexual acts was 10, and the number of sexual partners in the prior 2 months was 8. What you can see on the next slide is the overall sexual behavior during the study period, and you can see that overall there was no significant change from baseline in terms of number of acts, number of partners, and use of condoms. And actually, only 30% use a condom for anal intercourse. And so, not unexpectedly, we've seen a pretty high rate of STI in the study, since overall 38 or 32% of the participants developed or presented with an STI during the study period. And you can see that the most frequent STI were chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis was a little bit less frequent. And we've seen also a couple of HDV infections. In terms of efficacy, that's the most important slide. You can see that after a mean follow-up of 13 months, 16 people became infected, 14 in the placebo arm in red, and 2 in the Truvada arm in blue. So this was actually highly different, very significant in terms of statistical relevance. You can see that the Loebrand test is with a p-value of less than 2 per 1,000. And this means that we've seen an 86% relative reduction in HIV incidence with Truvada as compared to placebo in the study, with a confidence interval, and the lower bound is 40%, which is, I would say, pretty high for a lower bound in such a prevention trial. And that could also be translated by the number of participants that you need to treat for 1 year to prevent one infection in this high-risk population. It was only 18. So this means that if you treat 18 people for 1 year, you would prevent one HIV infection. Another important insight from this data is the rate at which the events occurred, and you can see that in the placebo arm, you have a number of infections very early on during the first 6 months of the study. Almost half of the infection occurred during this period of time, so that means that these patients were, as we know, at high risk, and that the use of on-demand PrEP was able to prevent also these early events. And indeed, in the Truvada arm, the only 2 participants who became infected only after 16 months in the study, so late. These participants had discontinued their PrEP regimen a couple of months before becoming infected, and indeed, they were returning full bottles of drugs, and their detection of drug in plasma was actually negative. In terms of adherence measured by pill count, it's a complex figure, but you could see that overall, if you pull all participants in both arms, over time, you don't see a major change in the number of pills used by the participants. And overall, the median number of pills used per month was 16 instead of 30 if the participants were on a daily regimen. And of course, since the study was double-blind, you know, the number of pills used in the two arms was very similar. Interestingly, 12% of the participants in the two arms used a post-exposure prophylaxis. And again, because the study was double-blind, the same number of participants used PEP in both arms. But these figure doesn't tell you really how the participants individually took PrEP during the study, and this figure here gives you a better idea of, you know, what happened during the study. And each line represents one participant and his behavior in terms of pill taking over time. And if you take the first line on the top, you can see that the first participants during the first month used between 11 and 18 pills. Then at the M2 and M4 visit, he used only between 4 and 11 pills per month. And then he used more pills at the next visit, and then fewer pills. And you can see that over time, probably according to his sexual activity and his willingness to use PrEP or not, his adherence to the number of pills changed, and that's exactly what we wanted to provide to these people. It was an on-demand regimen, so we really wanted to put the choice of using PrEP or not in the hands of the people, and according to their partners, the type of sexual intercourse, it was up to them to decide to use or not a condom, PrEP, both, or none. And when we asked the participants what they have done during their last sexual intercourse, we were able to assess, you know, more than 1,000 sexual intercourse. They told us that in 28% of these sexual intercourse, they didn't use PrEP at all. And again, that means that, you know, they were not using PrEP even for each sexual intercourse, but only for those that they felt could be associated with the risk of HIV transmission or acquisition. In terms of safety, and that's obviously a concern for a healthy individual willing to prevent the risk of HIV infection, what's the safety of an on-demand regimen with Truvada? The safety was actually pretty good. You see, and that's also the benefit of being in a placebo-controlled study, because since you don't know, and the physician doesn't know either who is on Truvada, who is on placebo, that gives you a really better idea of what events are really related to the use of the drug. And you could see that overall, the vast majority of people presented with at least one adverse event, 82% versus 89%, but of course, all these events were probably not related to the use of pills. In terms of serious adverse events of grade 3 or 4, which means very serious adverse events, the rate was also similar between the two arms. Only one participant discontinued Truvada because the physician suspected that there was a drug-drug interaction between the treatment, the study treatment and the event. It was a patient in the Truvada arm, but we're not sure that even in these patients, there was a true drug-drug interaction. The only difference was seen in what was reported as drug-related gastrointestinal adverse events, where 13% of the participants in the Truvada arm complained of these gastrointestinal adverse events, but also 6% in the placebo arm. So overall, you could say that only 7% with Truvada really had drug-related gastrointestinal adverse events, which were mainly nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain. In terms of diarrhea, you could see that, you know, a similar number of people complain of diarrhea in the two arms. When you look at now lab abnormalities, as expected with Truvada, you had more elevation in plasma creatinine level, but these were only grade 1, meaning very low level increase. And you could see that it was 14% of the participants with Truvada, but also 7% with placebo. So, in other words, only 7% with Truvada had the true probably increase related to the use of the drug, but no difference in terms of proteinuria or glycosuria, because we know tenofovir can induce proximal tubulopathy, but here we didn't see that. And clearly it seems that, you know, the intermittent use of tenofovir, as we know in patients with HIV infection, is probably a good way to prevent or reduce the risk of renal and tubular toxicity. In terms of ALT, meaning liver enzyme elevation, again, no difference between the two arms, and the only people who presented with severe grade 3 and 4 liver enzyme elevation were people having actually acute HCV infection at that time or syphilis. So this was clearly not related to the use of the drugs. So in conclusion, you know, one of the lessons from the trial was that the incidence of HIV infection in the placebo arm was much higher than we thought it would be. We assume it would be in the range of 3%, and actually it was much higher than that, 6.6% overall, and actually with differences from places to places. In Paris alone, the incidence was above 9%, so very, very high. And that explains why actually we were able to conclude on the efficacy of PrEP with fewer events that we anticipated. The only reason why we could discontinue the study earlier than expected was because the efficacy that we have seen was higher than the one we expected. We expected to see a 50% reduction of HIV incidence, and we've seen 86%, so much higher. And so having a much higher incidence, a much higher effectiveness, explains why we didn't need to have, I mean, as many participants as we thought we would need initially. So the adherence to PrEP was also pretty good, and that suggests that the participants were able to adapt their behavior to the use of PrEP on demand and to use it or not. The safety, as I just said, was pretty good, except for the gastrointestinal adverse events. We didn't see any change in sexual behavior during the study, but it was double-blind against placebo, and so that would be that's going to be interesting to see in the open label phase of the study whether or not this will be sustained. And so our conclusion was, the last bullet point here, you know, underlying that on-demand PrEP seems to be attractive and could be an alternative to daily PrEP for high-risk MSM who do want to use condoms for their sexual intercourses. And I guess that's it. And, you know, the next slides are just to thank the funders, of course, the participants, and all people involved in the study.
Great. Jean-Michel, thank you so very, very much. A terrific overview, and congratulations to you and the entire team for the result. Number of questions have come in, which are terrific. Again, avac@avac.org. Via email, you can continue to use the chat feature. And we'll open up the line shortly, but want to quickly now turn to Sheena McCormick from the Medical Research Council in the United Kingdom, who is the principal investigator of the PROUD study, want to shift to her. And Sheena, if you want, you can control the slides yourself, or we can for you. And you can hit *7 to unmute yourself.
Okay, I think I'm unmuted.
You are. Do you want to advance your own slides, or would you like us to?
I can do that, I think, just with the arrows on the keyboard. Is that right?
That is exactly right.
Okay, perfect. No, thank you. And thank you so much for organizing the call. So I will go. I think my disclaimers are there, is what I'm seeing at the moment. So Gilead kindly provided us drug free of charge for PROUD and distributed it to the clinics and gave us a small grant for diagnostics, including PK sub-study. So there we go, I see. Just to briefly explain for those of you not familiar with the sexual health service that we have in England, we have a network of over 200 clinics, and they're linked through professional guidelines. They're accessed by over 100,000 HIV-negative gay men each year, and the diagnoses that are made in those clinics with respect to sexually transmitted infections and the services provided, like post-exposure prophylaxis, et cetera, and Hep B immunization, are all reported into Public Health England and collated each year. So we have a reasonable data set over time from which to estimate the rate of new infections in HIV-negative gay men. And as similarly to Jean-Michel, that brings us to a estimate of about 3% per year who will catch HIV. So when IPRIX reported the 44% reduction in HIV, we were very excited about this, because if we were able to achieve that in the UK setting, that would really be a very significant impact. We have over 2,000 new infections each year. But we were a little bit worried that effectiveness might not be so good in the real world. We knew that in the trial, participants had come every month, and we planned to see them every quarter, which fitted with the routine screening for STIs. We have limited resources for adherence support in the clinics. We also speculated that sexual behavior might be riskier, that people might abandon condoms altogether, knowing that they were taking a tablet that could reduce their risk of HIV. And although we do have resources for behavior change in the clinics, they are limited, and they've only really been introduced in the last 2 to 3 years. So in order to address those questions, you have to create a situation where some people have PrEP and some people have no PrEP. I don't know if this will work. I can see the arrow. Hopefully you can too. So we did that by randomizing men to have Truvada straight away in the risk reduction package or to get it only after the first year of follow-up. So in that first year of follow-up, you've created a situation where you've got PrEP or no PrEP. And who did we enroll? Well, gay and other men who have sex with men who reported condomless anal sex in the last 90 days and the likelihood of this happening in the next 90 days had to be over 18, and of course they had to be willing to take a pill every day. And we needed to exclude people who needed treatment for Hep B because obviously they couldn't have lopinavir, or of course if Truvada was contraindicated. And then, as I mentioned, we followed people every quarter for 2 years was the original plan. We did have one extra visit a month after people started their PrEP just to check everything was going okay. And our main endpoints, because this was just a pilot study to see if we could do the sort of scale of trial we thought we needed to do, was just to see if we could recruit and retain people in this design, because we kind of speculated that if you didn't get anything for a year, you might not stay in follow-up. But then from April of last year, when we presented the baseline characteristics to our trial steering committee, it was clear from some of the baseline factors that the cohort that we'd enrolled might have a much higher rate of HIV than we anticipated. And so we turned to HIV infection as our main endpoint, and we appointed an independent data monitoring committee to look at the HIV infections by these two different groups, PrEP versus no PrEP. And we tried as much as we could to mimic the real world, so we used very basic tests. We didn't have viral load. We just used the fourth-generation serology, which has the P24 antigen detection in it. So that becomes positive a little bit after the viral load. We only used serum creatinine at baseline. We didn't wait for the result before starting people on treatment, and we planned just to do it once a year. But we did repeat it if there was one plus of protein on a urine dipstick, which is a simple test in clinic. And then mostly STIs were quarterly throughout, as indicated in the clinic. HIV, of course, syphilis, hepatitis C was not always indicated, but if it was, we would check for that. And then gonorrhea and chlamydia from three sites most commonly, oral, rectal, and in urine. And then if behavior change interventions, we would discuss this in clinic, but we would just refer for those within our routine clinic. So the sort of things we have in the clinics are sexual risk reduction strategies, group or one-to-one, adherence support, you know, pill boxes and things like that, as well as counseling for adherence. And then people are having trouble with recreational drugs and addiction. There are services in many clinics for those too. So we have very limited study procedures that we added on top of that. But, of course, there were the data questionnaires that we completed in the clinics. And also we asked participants to complete questionnaires in clinics. So coming to the population and the prescribing that we did and tolerability, we enrolled 545 men, and they were assigned 276 to PrEP straight away and 269 to the no PrEP or deferred group. In terms of baseline characteristics, they were very similar to the IPA-gay cohort, so the median age with 35. About a third of people were under 30 and a third of people over 40. The majority were white, so slightly lower proportion than ethnic gay, and quite a large proportion, 40%, were born outside the UK. They were very highly educated, as with the ethnic gay population, mainly employed, mostly self-identified as gay, and just over half were single. There was a high level of recreational drug use overall, but this included Viagra and poppers. If you look just at the recreational drugs used for chemsex, it's more like a third to 40%. So in terms of prescribing, we had 5% of the cohort who may never have started PrEP. They never had any drug prescribed after the baseline prescription. About just over half, 56%, had enough drug prescribed to have taken one every single day. And overall in the study, 86% of the days were covered by drug. Now that's, I think, in many ways probably an underestimate of the adherence, because people, because in terms of days when people were at risk that were covered, it's likely to be higher than this. People did have interruptions, which made sense, because they weren't having any sexual risk in a long period. Anecdotally, in the deferred group, one or two, a small number of participants did report that they were either accessing multiple PEP to use as PrEP, or they were using PrEP, which they were managing to access from other means. But it was a very small proportion of participants that reported that. However, if we look at the post-exposure prophylaxis use, that was very high in the no PrEP group. So 83 participants, 31% of the cohort, had post-exposure prophylaxis at some time in that first year of follow-up, and they had a total of 174 prescriptions. We did have some post-exposure prophylaxis used in the immediate group. This was mainly triggered by people who had started their, who had not started their PrEP and then had a condom incident, came in and rolled straight from PEP onto PrEP. In some other cases, they were particularly anxious at an exposure and requested that the PrEP was escalated up to PEP with the third drug. In terms of tolerability, only 28 participants actually interrupted PrEP. And this is in both groups. This is using information from the deferred people who'd passed month 12 and gone on to drug. Only 13 participants had an event that was considered to be related to drugs. So some of these events were admissions to hospital for other reasons when they stopped drug. As with EPA-GAY and other trials in PrEP, a lot of these were abdominal. The largest proportion were abdominal. There were a couple who interrupted because of creatinine clearance but resumed again, two headaches, and then other miscellaneous ones. But 11 of these 13 participants have successfully restarted their PrEP. In terms of the HIV endpoint, so now we're moving on from the numbers that were enrolled in each group to those that couldn't contribute to the analysis. So there were three people who were positive at enrollment, two in the PrEP group and one in the no PrEP group. There were 19 individuals who never had an HIV test in follow-up, so they cannot contribute to the main analysis. But over 96% of participants did contribute some time. Now, it was complicated by the fact we changed the protocol in October and therefore brought some people back early to access PrEP. So to add up all the person years, in some cases we're able to take it from the beginning all the way through to month 12, but in others, it was only to the time of access to PrEP, which might have been ahead of month 12, or in fact, in some cases, it was after month 12 if they came back late for that appointment, or to the diagnosis of HIV infection. And when we look at the completeness of follow-up, how much did we observe over what we would have expected if everybody had come back perfectly according to the protocol, which in my experience never happens in a clinical trial, we had a 92% of person years in the PrEP group and 88% in the no PrEP group. So a very good level of follow-up. And we were reassured by this in the no PrEP group because, as I mentioned, we weren't sure people would be willing to come back. So now I'd like to, I know I'm very conscious of the time here, Mitchell, but just like to spend a bit of time on this, because this is a slide that the participants, when we've shown it to them, have queried a little bit and wanted more information about. There were three new infections in the PrEP group and the immediate group, and what you're seeing here, if you look at the first bar, is the most recent HIV test that was negative in the study and the first positive HIV test. So for this particular individual, his most recent negative test was actually at enrollment, and he came back early ahead of schedule because the first scheduled HIV test in the study is actually here at week 12. And he came back early because he'd had a very significant risk a week before he enrolled, and unfortunately his test here was positive. So we're very confident, actually, that he was taking his drug because of other tests that we did, but we believe that his main risk for acquiring HIV was too early for the drug to have worked. This individual didn't come back after baseline, so he had a baseline negative test. He took the prescription away. He never came back again, and he actually was diagnosed at another clinic, and we have very little information about him. We don't have absolute direct information that he wasn't taking his PrEP during this period, but we speculate that he wasn't. This individual did come back, came back after enrollment once and twice, and he collected those prescriptions, but then he didn't come back again. And when he was admitted to hospital with a seroconversion illness here, he told the hospital staff that he hadn't been taking his PrEP for months. And again, we have other tests that validate that and suggest indeed that this occurred off PrEP. So those three infections in the immediate group, the 19 in the deferred, and some people might say, well, maybe you can't count these two and maybe you can't count these six because they might have been seroconverting at the time they entered the study. But then you'll be left with only one in the immediate group and 13 in the deferred group, which is a very, very large difference. But according to our statistical plan, we use all 22 infections, the three in the PrEP group, the 19 in the deferred. The 19 in the deferred give us an incidence rate of 8.9. So as Jean-Michel said, much higher than we expected. This was three times higher than we expected to find. When you look at the actual effectiveness, I think I should probably put here, that is 86% reduction by extraordinary coincidence, the same as EPAGAY, and this is our 90% confidence interval around that. So very significant. And when you take these two rates away from each other to calculate the number needed to treat, it's only 13. It's an incredibly low number needed to treat. So drug resistance, we did see that in three out of six individuals who were seroconverting around baseline in the immediate group or month 12 in the deferred group. They had the 184 mutations as a mixture with wild type, and we saw no K65R. And it didn't give us a clinical problem in terms of treating these individuals. So STI endpoints. So here in this graph, what you're seeing is the proportion of men who at some point in follow-up had an infection. In the first two columns, it's any sexually transmitted infection, including those that are in the oral cavity. The blue bar is PrEP, immediate, and the red bar is no PrEP, deferred. So 57% had an STI at some point, and 50% of the deferred. If we look only at the rectal infections, the rectal gonorrhea or chlamydia, then we see here it's 35%, I think, and 32% in the deferred. Now, although the blue bars are higher than the red bars throughout, none of these results were statistically significant. And I think, will it come up? Yes, so with the caveat that we also have recorded on the database a much higher number of screens for the those on PrEP compared to those not on PrEP. So 974 rectal screens for the immediate group on PrEP and only 749 for those not on PrEP. So a greater chance to have a positive finding, if you like, in the PrEP group. Sexual behavior, coming on to the last data slide now. We asked this, the only data we're able to use, because the self-completed questionnaires by the participants were something obviously they didn't like doing very much, because less than half of them completed the questionnaires as we went along. But we do have the annual questionnaires, a limited data set for the long-term follow-up of 349 compared to baseline. But if you look here at the median number of partners, so this means that 50% of those on PrEP had reported 10 or less in at baseline, and this is very similar, of course, between the two groups. But when you look at the number of partners with whom anal sex occurred without a condom, this is much, much lower. So only 3 for the immediate, 2 for deferred, 2.5 here and 3 here. So there's a lot of condom use going on at baseline. And actually, that's exactly what we saw in the follow-up at a year, or when people came back to access PrEP. Again, much higher numbers of total partners than you see condomless anal sex partners. So none of these differences are significant, with the caveat that these data are preliminary. So in conclusion, we too saw a higher incidence in this population who came forward to access PrEP than we predicted based on all the gay men attending sexual health clinics. And I guess that's not surprising, because we know not all gay men attending sexual health clinics are at risk of HIV. Now, this was despite extensive use of post-exposure in the deferred period. So that 9 per 100 person years incidence is still with access, full access to PEP. Our concerns about PrEP being less effective in the real world were obviously completely unfounded. It proved to be highly effective. Gay men seem to incorporate PrEP into their existing risk reduction strategies, which did continue to use include condom use. We didn't see any difference in the SDIs, which are the very objective marker of differences in behavior. They were very common, of course, in both groups. And the clinics were able to adapt their routine practice to incorporate PrEP. So that's the end of my conclusion, and I too would like to acknowledge the study participants, to whom the credit must go, because they obviously took the drug very well and stayed with us in the study, the team at MRCCTU and at Public Health England, and these wonderful clinics who did all this mainly for nothing. They didn't really see any real money to do this study. Our oversight committees, the Trial Steering Committee and the Data Monitoring Committee, a community engagement group who really helped with recruitment and oversaw all the dissemination, and the Social Science Advisory Group who advised us on the questionnaires and the qualitative data collection. And, of course, Gilead, MRC and PHE for the money and the drug.
Great. So Gina. Oh, sorry.
Mitchell, I'm just going to say I'm so sorry that I have to leave you, but Mitzi is here, and I guess we ran over time, didn't we, one way or the other?
No, not a problem, Sheena. I was going to say thank you so much. I know you had to run, but I'm so pleased that you could present all of this, and delighted Mitzi's still on. We have a terrific number of questions coming in, and that I'll field off to Mitzi and Jean-Michel and others on the call. But want to thank you as well, and congratulate you and the whole team, and thank both you and Jean-Michel for not only presenting, and the time spent is worth it to get more detail, and also want to thank you both for being so incredibly accurate in both getting to 86%. I don't think anyone would have predicted that. So thank you so very much. I don't know if you have time for questions, but there's, as I say, a bunch have come in, but one that really is for both you and Jean-Michel, and then a couple for Jean-Michel, but perhaps what next in Europe specifically, and I don't know if you have time to answer that as you dash off, or for Mitzi and for Jean-Michel, in terms of regulatory plans within the UK and France, but also in Europe generally. A number of questions came in, so I don't know if anyone wants to answer that one.
I could have a go quickly before I go, Mitchell, because I
think... Did you want me to take it? I don't mind.
Will you, Mitchell? That's okay. That's brilliant, because I've just scanned the questions, and they do seem to be mainly for Jean-Michel.
Okay.
Which was our experience in Seattle, wasn't it, Jean-Michel? All right. I will say bye-bye, Mitzi, and thank you.
All right.
So maybe, Mitzi, just if you want to say a quick word, and then I'll turn it over to Jean-Michel and then ask some other questions to him.
Sure. Okay. So in terms of the UK, the steps that are going on at the moment are the HIV Clinical Reference Group, who advise NHS England on the commissioning of HIV services, established a subgroup in September last year to look at the evidence around PrEP. Now, once we announced the change in October, they increased their timelines, and they've met twice already and have got another meeting this month. It is their role to review all of the evidence, to look at the cost-effectiveness data that is being prepared by Public Health England and UCL, and then work towards making a recommendation by the end of the year to another committee on whether PrEP should be available in through NHS England or not. If NHS England decided that it was a cost-effective option and they could include it, then PrEP could actually be commissioned from April next year. There are a number of complexities around that, not least because it is NHS England who would pay for the drugs, but actually our local authorities who are now responsible for paying for sexual health services. So there are still ongoing discussions around any additional oversight or review that would be necessary. But they're the main steps for England, although that does differ for the devolved authorities such as Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Great, and I'm not going to even touch the politics of that. Michelle, do you want to talk a bit about France? And also, I think an important point that someone actually raised in a great question, Canada too, because IPRGAY did take place in Canada as well as in France.
Right. You mean, well, in France, can you hear me?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, good. So in France, the process is moving forward, and actually the regulatory agency in France has said that they will speed up the process in order to get a scientific advice for the expanded access program, because we don't need in France to have approval from the European level to provide PrEP since the drug is already on the market, but we need approval for an expanded access program, and they might grant this expanded access program this summer or a little bit later. Of course, it is a sensitive issue right now, and we have election in France, and we have had a little bit of a fight with the gay marriage a couple of months ago. So again, it's a sensitive issue, but I guess more physicians, people are now convinced that this is the way to go, and that we should implement PrEP in our preventive strategies. I don't know how fast this will occur. We hope, as soon as possible.
Great. Thank you. And Jean-Michel, a number of questions have come in, and I know this happened a lot in Seattle as well, but a couple of them cluster around this issue about participants who may have had lower frequency of intercourse. And what we know about, if someone's only having sex once a month, do you have any sense of protection broken out by people's sexual frequency?
The thing is, we cannot do that. First, because there would not be a rigorous analysis, because there would be post hoc analysis, and you have to be very careful with this type of analysis. Second, we only had two participants infected in the Truvada arm, and we know that these two participants didn't take PrEP. So that was the reason why they were not protected, not because they were using, they were having, fewer sexual intercourses, but it's only because they didn't take PrEP. So then you cannot really, do sub-analysis. What you could look at is at the sexual behavior of the people who actually in the placebo arm became infected. And actually in this group of people, because you would assume that since the study was double blind versus placebo, if everyone had placebo, you would have the same number of events, the same rate of events. And, in the placebo arm, those who were infected had a different, pattern of sexual behavior. And so you don't have a consistent behavior in terms of PrEP use or sexual intercourse. So really, and that was our inclusion criteria, you know, on average, people had two sexual intercourse a week, but they use only PrEP to cover, let's say, one sexual intercourse, since the median use of pills was four per week. But it would be difficult to know, to answer your question specifically. And, you know, a single study would not be able to answer all the questions that you may have. What I could say is, you know, a way to approach this concern, and I understand that this is an important question for those who have sex once a month, would they be, will they be protected by this on-demand regimen? Well, the answer is we don't know for sure if we would achieve the same level of protection that we've seen in the study. Could we say that there would be no protection? I don't think so. I think there might be some protection, but we don't know exactly the level of protection. So I would say for these people, you know, they would be better off to use a condom if they have, you know, sexual behavior at risk of HIV acquisition once a month. Or should they want to be on a daily regimen to prevent just one sexual exposure a month? You know, and you may want to discuss this on a case-by-case basis. I think that the way or the rate at which the events accumulated in the placebo arm gives you an idea that, you know, the PrEP regimen with on-demand PrEP was active very early in the study, meaning that people were protected very early on. We don't know about their first sexual intercourse at risk of HIV acquisition, but at least very early on. And a recent paper was published in CID based on data from daily PrEP, suggesting that with five pills in a row, you may achieve a level in terms of drug level in blood or in tissues that would be enough to protect you against HIV acquisition. So again, these are assumptions, these are post hoc analysis, but that gives you an idea that with four, five pills, well, you start to get some protection, probably. It would be very, very difficult to set up a study to really answer this issue, because that would mean to have people at low risk of HIV acquisition, and therefore it would be very, very difficult to show any benefit from preventive strategies in that case. So, again, if you look at the data from the study in terms of sexual behavior, you have the median and you have what we call the M to quartile range, which gives you an idea of, you know, how these participants were scattered in terms of behavior. And if I can back the slide, I don't know if I can do that, actually.
I think you can.
Okay, let's look at the slide there on sexual behavior. Where is it? At baseline. Oh. So you can see here that in the previous 4 weeks, it was 10, but you have the lower bound, or the lower interquartile was 6 or 5, meaning that within these last 4 weeks, you had 25% of the population who had only 5 to 6 sexual intercourse in the prior 4 weeks, meaning on average, let's say 1. And if you go to the slides in terms of number of pills, okay, again, when you look at the median number of pill use was 16, but the interquartile was 10, meaning that 25% of the population used 10 pills or less per month, meaning if you need 4 pills for a sexual intercourse, that means 2 sexual intercourse in the last month. So that's the kind of, you know, analysis we could do with these data. It may not answer specifically your question, but again, when you look at the, you know, the rate of events, you could see, you know, with a placebo arm, as soon as 2 months after the study started and the participants were starting to take their drugs, you know that in the Truvada arm they were protected, whereas in the placebo arm, an event started to accumulate. So, you know, difficult to tell you how soon you can be protected. would it be at the first sexual intercourse, but very, very early. So that's, I guess, the farthest I could go with the data we have.
No, I think that that's incredibly helpful, and it's an, obviously a question that has been asked a lot over the last few weeks, and I think will continue to be asked in terms of how soon does one get protection, how many pills does it take. I wonder, and a number of questions also cluster then around what's the bottom line message, and I guess perhaps, I know we're just at the top of the hour, I believe you can stay a little bit longer, and it looks like we have a lot of people still on the line. Maybe, but to you, and I believe Don Smith from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who's led a lot of the guidance development here in the U.S., is on the line as well, but maybe a question then to both of you in terms of what might be the message going forward to an individual interested in PrEP and or providers in terms of what we actually can say with the evidence and in terms of guiding possible dosing and both as an individual clinician as well as a potential user. I don't know if either one of you have thoughts. And, John, if you want to, star 7 to unmute yourself as well.
You know, maybe I would like to add one thing. You know, again, the data we have, you know, we're able in some ways to replicate pretty well what we've seen in the macaque model. And in the macaque model, again, if you go back to the data in the macaque model, it seems that you were able to protect the macaque with pretty early, again, the first challenges were able to use infection in the control animals, and the treated animals seem to be in some ways protected also early on. So, in other words, what I would say to be on the safe side would be that, you know, for those using at least 4 pills a week, it seems that the efficacy could be very high and probably in the same level as with a daily regimen. So meaning that you may not need to take, you know, the pills every day to achieve high level of protection as long as you take the pills at the right time, because I think it should be or it might help. Now, of course, we have less evidence for those using that length less than 4 pills a week. But again, does that mean that this is not effective at all? I just don't know. You know, you may think that the efficacy could be reduced. And anyway, it would be, you know, false to let people think that you can be protected 100% with the PrEP regimen, whether you take it daily or on demand. And again, the two studies, PRAD and IPAGAY, have not enrolled thousands of people, so it would be dangerous to let people think that this is fully effective if you take the PrEP regimen. I think you reduce the risk quite significantly, but it's not like a full protection. But again, in terms of prevention at the population level to try to, you know, contain the epidemic, if you implement a tool like PrEP in combination with, you know, frequent testing for HIV, which is critical, using the right test to detect primary HIV infection, and being able to provide immediate treatment to those diagnosed with HIV infection, I think that's the combination of all these tools that will make a difference.
Great, really helpful, and I think the caveats you described really important for all of us to hear. Dawn, I don't know if you've been able to unmute with Star 7, if you want to have a comment on that as well.
Sure. I think, you know, we find this data very interesting, but I think it's important to look not only at the overall trial effectiveness finding, but to look at some of the adherence data. And I think when we combine those things from all the trials, from the daily trials as well as from this trial, I think our take-home message is that if you take PrEP regularly, it offers a fair amount of protection, and that daily use offers more protection than less than daily use. So I think here we're going to continue to recommend daily use. I think the other part of the message, though, is that one of the things that this study confirms that some of the modeling from IPREP has shown is that you don't don't need perfect adherence to get high protection. So if I'm trying to take it every day and I miss a couple of doses here and there, that I still have very high levels of protection. I think what we don't know from this...
Don, I'm sorry. If you could speak up a little bit or closer to the phone, I think people were having a little hard time hearing you.
I think what we don't know from this one study is whether these regimens will work if you start them only a few hours before sex, and particularly given the data that was shown that even the men who used PrEP often didn't use it, all four doses as they were supposed to take them. And in the monkey studies, for example, if you used the pre-dose and you didn't use the post-dose, you didn't get protection. So I think considering the adherence to all of the doses and not just kind of the overall efficacy is pretty important. The human PK data suggests that taking even two doses 2 or 3 hours before sex is not enough to get you adequate protection at the rectal tissue, which is where you would want it to be, which is why the post doses are very important. It's also concerning looking at the IAVI data and the HPTN-067 data that were presented at CROI that adherence is higher to daily dosing than it is to intermittent dosing. So I think this is a very useful study in terms of how much do you need to take the drug in order to get good levels of protection. The last thing I will say is that we're obviously concerned about preventing HIV, not just in MSM. And there are lots of reasons why this data may not tell us anything about the use of PrEP for heterosexual women or for injection drug users. And so, you know, we're really excited to see both the PROUD data and the EPRGAY data, which both confirm that at least for MSM, if you take the drug regularly, it offers you a lot of protection against HIV.
Great. Thanks so much, Ron, and thanks for raising the issue about other populations. I know it's a question that came up from a number of people via email and in chat, and I do want to remind people, although this call focuses, of course, on the EPRGAY and PROUD data amongst gay men and other men who have sex with men, data presented at CROI and then on the Monday webinar from the Partners Demonstration Project did focus on heterosexual transmission within serodiscordant couples. So one of the points we certainly would want to be sure, I think, on behalf of IRMA and the Prevention Justice Alliance is that although this call is focusing on data in MSM, PrEP is not only a conversation and a proven method amongst men who have sex with men. So really great points. I know, again, we're over the hour, but I wonder, and there are other questions that are certainly coming in, but I wonder if we'll just stop and let, if anyone has questions from the line, you can hit *7, particularly, both Jim Pickett at IRMA and Suraj at Prevention Justice Alliance. I don't know if you have any additional questions or comments you want to make, but I'll go ahead and pause now. Hit *7 if you want to unmute your line. Anybody?
Hi, Mitchell. This is Jim. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hello, Jim.
Hi. So, yeah, thanks for a great presentation. Thanks to everybody, and really great data, really exciting. This would probably be for Jean-Michel and perhaps Dawn as well. Hearing everything that's just been said, do you see value in having very individualized treatment plans for people who the EPRGAY regimen might be more effective? So you're sitting down and counseling them. They're interested in PrEP, and they don't really have sex that frequently. They have a boyfriend out of town, and they see each other once a month, what have you. And, you know, taking a pill every day is just not going to be such a great idea for them. But they're interested in this EPRGAY model. I mean, how do you feel about having kind of the top-line messages? We really think people should take it every day. But when we're kind of dealing with people at the individual level, having some ability to offer a regimen that's going to work for them. If they pick a regimen that's going to work for them, it's likely that the intervention will work as opposed to forcing a regimen on them or, quote, forcing something on them that isn't a good fit. So thoughts about that, because a lot of us are starting to think about how we message this and how we talk to this at the social marketing level, the public health level, how we talk about this at the individual level, and just trying to get our heads around.
I guess that's one of the most difficult questions to answer with the data we have. Again, the data that we have with these on-demand regimen, have been obtained in a, as you've seen, randomized double-blind placebo-controlled studies. So this is the best evidence you could get with this type of regimen. So it worked fine in the population that we've enrolled and according to their behavior. And of course, this is one piece of information. And it's in medicine in general, we don't have always, randomized trials or the patients in front of us doesn't sit always in the inclusion criteria of the trials that have established the treatment guidelines or the treatment standards. So I think for this individual having sex at risk of HIV acquisition once a month, it doesn't fit perfectly in the population that we have enrolled in the trial. So then you have to try to extrapolate these data. Could you do that? Again, you have some animal data that could be useful. You could think that, part of the population in hypergay had not such a high frequency of sexual intercourse. You have, as I said, the fact that most events or a pretty high number of events in the placebo arm occurred pretty early. So all of that would suggest that you can be protected. You don't have to wait for too long to get protected with this on-demand regimen. Could you be protected for, sexual intercourse once a month? I think we don't really know the answer at this point. And you may assume that the protection might be lower than with, of course, a daily regimen if the daily regimen is taken. If it's not taken, then if individual doesn't want to take a daily regimen, then you have options. And on-demand PrEP is one option. Would it be 100% effective? Probably not. Could it reduce the risk of HIV infection? I would think that it could or it should. But I don't know exactly the amount of reduction. That would be very difficult to know. We've done a sub-study that we have not yet presented, looking at the speed at which the drugs can be detected in the rectal tissue following oral intake in a subgroup of participants, only in a small number of participants. And these data would suggest that some drug can be detected early on after drug intake in the rectal tissue. But we know that the drug can be detected very early in blood after drug intake, half an hour to 1 hour after drug intake, you have a peak in blood concentration of tenofovir and FTC. In the rectal tissue, that was interesting to look at, the level that we can achieve within minutes after a drug intake or hours. Again, that would not give you full evidence that you can be fully protected, but this provide you another information that you might want to use when you have to make your decision with your patient, and that your patient would have to decide with the data we have whether or not he's ready to take a daily pill, and if he or she or he, as long as right now I think it would be safe to focus the discussion only on MSM, if he's ready to not ready to take a daily regimen, then on-demand could be interesting, and that would be probably better than taking nothing if he doesn't want to use a condom.
Thank you so much, Jean-Michel. John, I don't know, do you want to comment at all? All right, Don may not be on, or Don may be back on. Star 7, Don, if you are there. All right. I know we have a lot of people still there. Other questions or comments? Again.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, this is Yutana Dema of ACT UP New York, and I want to thank Dr. Molina for his clarifications regarding the caveats around intermittent dosing in an infrequent scenario. However, I will note that this data will definitely, I already am aware that it's being metabolized in certain communities at risk and that it will affect some people's behavior. So my own comment would be that for individuals, say on bareback RT, a very active barebacking only MSM site, that somebody who's scheduled a Friday night orgy for themselves when they travel, and this is actually a very frequent occurrence, is somebody that I would advise in an intermittent prep scenario where they are not continuously dosing, that they might limit their that initial window after a double dose to some more reliably saturated time window, such as, say, 3 to 12 hours instead of 2 to 24 after a double dose. And I personally plan on noting all the caveats that have been offered here, but I don't think that the official disposition of simply writing off intermittent PrEP is going to be workable. I think it will be a great position for institutions, but on the line, in the streets, and in the bedrooms, and in the clubs, and dark corners, intermittent PrEP is going to need to be explained. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, Anton. Comments at all, Jean-Michel or Donna?
I'm not sure I have... And this is the point clearly, but I think it's, the message about intermittent PrEP is first that, you know, the way we proposed to use it worked in the study. And I think that we'll make overall PrEP, I would say more attractive so that people can think about PrEP differently than, you know, having to commit to a daily regimen. And letting people think that, you know, PrEP could work even though you're not taking, you know, a daily drug for months is interesting. And that can give you also information about, you know, when to stop, when to start, even for a daily regimen. And you can start having discussion. And I guess people that might be reluctant to engage in or to start a daily regimen might be interesting to talk to their physician about, you know, what about on-demand PrEP, and in the discussion then, you know, that would be up to the physician to decide whether or not he wants, according to his patient's behavior, wants to recommend daily or intermittent. And, you know, it is not that different, except that, you know, it might fit better some people than others.
Great. I do think it very much, I think, Jim Pickett, you asked it as well about, you know, there are issues, and as Jatan, you describe it too, issues for policymakers and how it's described in some settings. It's obviously a provider will need to interpret this information, and individuals will make decisions, and I think the job for all of us is to get as much of this information out that is, you know, accurate so that people of all of those categories can make good decisions. But
the problem is that we, sorry to interrupt you, Mitchell, but but we have only one efficacy study looking at on-demand PrEP, whereas we have many other studies looking at daily PrEP. So obviously we have, I mean, less information with an on-demand regimen that we have with daily regimen. And, you know, when we started the study, there was a lot of skepticism about, you know, using an on-demand regimen because, and we faced discussion before when we started our first trial with once daily ART for HIV infected people. That was 15 years ago. The discussion with the pharmacologists were, you know, well, this is kind of risky, you know, business. Here also, there was some concern that an on-demand regimen would not work as well as a daily regimen, but, you know, the data are accumulating and the four-pill regimen that we proposed for one sexual intercourse was not that different from, you know, the four pills that have been suggested in a post-hoc analysis of other studies to be associated with a very significant reduced risk. So this is, a prospective demonstration that these four pills per week works. But if you compare these four pills per week with the four pills per week taken in IPREX, for example, where the risk reduction was 42%, here, using the four pills probably at the right time, you increase the protection. So, again, I think when you have data from a clinical trial, it is right to use these data and to, use these data for people who are very similar to those enrolled in the study. And if you want to be, you know, very rigorous about, you know, for, you know, to who are the people who might benefit from this on-demand regimen, you should use the same inclusion criteria that we had in the study, people having, you know, unprotected anal sex, and people with baseline characteristics that are similar to those in our study. If you have a person that, you know, has similar baseline characteristics as those that we enroll in the Alpergate trial, you know, and if this participant is taking the pills as we have instructed our participants to take them, this participant should reduce significantly his risk of becoming infected. That's, you know, the best way to, you know, translate these data for, you know, routine practice, I would say.
And I think, Jean-Michel, you said it several times on this call, and I think it's an important reminder. We may all use different language, or on-demand, event-driven, sex-driven, any number of ways to describe the dosing regimen. But I think the point you've made several times in your study and in the IPREX study is that four pills seem to be a minimum threshold. And I think that's a really important point for all of us to think about how we communicate that. It's not, you know, take a pill and you're fine, or you're protected, even partially, because we don't have evidence of that. But this idea that we do have evidence that the four-pill threshold is a critical piece of information, no matter who we're communicating with, and I think something we all need to be thinking about.
Okay. I'm sorry, but I would need to leave now.
No problem. I realize it's late in Paris. We've kept you long. And many of you on this line, it's wonderful to see so much interest. This has obviously not been the first call about PrEP in any dosing strategy. It will surely not be the last. It speaks to the growing body of evidence and the excitement around it, and the fact that we can talk in 2015 about PrEP in different forms and fashions, different dosing schedules. Someone did ask a question about other drugs, and there's an enormous pipeline, and that needs to be accelerated orally and in other delivery systems for all populations. And these kinds of calls will obviously continue. I want to thank you, Jean-Michel, Mitzi, and Sheena for being part of this call. Especially want to thank Irma and the HIV Prevention Justice Alliance for co-sponsoring this week's series of calls on all these different issues. And also remind people that it's part of a much larger year-long conversation, putting prevention on the line and making sure that in the needs and midst of expanding essential treatment access, we need to ensure prevention in all its forms, not just PrEP and microbicide, but many other prevention modalities need to continue as part of a truly comprehensive response. And I want to thank everybody for sticking with it for now almost 90 minutes. And again, we'll keep the conversation going. Keep the questions coming, and we will surely be following up on this particular issue and many of the related ones as well. So thanks all. Thank you, Jim and Siraj, and I look forward to talking with you all very soon. And thanks again, Jean-Michel and Mitzi and Sheena.
You're very welcome. Thank you.